You're listening to the Body Pros CME and CE podcast coverage of IDSA 2007, the 45th annual meeting of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. To learn more about this CME and CE activity, please visit us online at thebodypro.com/IDSA2007.
This podcast has been divided into two parts. You're listening to part one, in which Dr. Eric Darr discusses IDSA 2007 studies related to challenges of current antiretroviral therapy. In part two, Dr. Darr looks at new antiretroviral options, emerging data from recently approved agents or agents available in expanded access.
Hi, I'm Eric Darr. I'm the chief of the Division of HIV Medicine at Harvard-UCLA Medical Center and a professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. And it's my pleasure to give you an update on some of the more important presentations that were provided at the 45th annual meeting of the Infectious Disease Society of America between October 4th and the 7th in 2007 in San Diego, California. The IDSA meeting comes shortly on the heels of several other very important meetings related to infectious diseases and HIV and AIDS, in particular the International AIDS Society meeting in Sydney, as well as ICCAC. And the purpose of IDSA has increasingly been to provide updated information for people in practice in the field, along with, to a lesser extent, I think, provide new science. And I think what we saw here at this meeting is consistent with that, in that we saw some new analyses of cohort data and clinical trials, which are going to be extremely important in helping us make decisions about treatment, but not a lot of other brand new data. And what I'm going to do today is cover some of these issues and particularly talk about some of the challenges we have with current therapy, discuss a little bit about what our new treatment options are and what data is emerging from some of the trials that have been presented over just the last months related to some of these new drugs that have either recently been approved, recommended for approval, or available in expanded access. So from the challenges of current therapy perspective, one of the things that I seem to get asked about more than just about anything else is this so-called phenomenon of discordance, where we have patients who are on suppressive antiretroviral therapy with completely undetectable levels of virus for prolonged periods of time, but don't have robust increases in their CD4 count. And there's always this concern as to how concerned we should be about these people developing complications of HIV and AIDS, and whether there's anything we should be doing differently with regards to their treatment. There were two presentations at this meeting that started to touch on some of these issues. One of them was from the group at the Washington University in St. Louis, where they defined a population of patients in clinical care. These were all people who had baseline CD4 counts of less than 350 cells per millimeter cubed and viral suppression for a minimum of 52 weeks. They defined those who were either discordant or non-discordant with regards to their CD4 increase on therapy. They arbitrarily defined those who were discordant, meaning good viral suppression without good CD4 increases, as those where the CD4 change was less than 150 cells, versus the concordant group, where there was what was perceived as a more appropriate CD4 increase of greater than or equal to 150 cells. They did a variety of analyses to try to define whether there are any baseline characteristics associated with being discordant versus concordant. They found, interestingly enough, that there was an increased risk in a multivariate analysis amongst those who were male, those who had lower pre-antiretroviral therapy HIV RNA viral loads, those who had used any unboosted adenovir, so people who had been treated in the distant past, and the greater number of antiretroviral-related side effects per person. All of these seem to be associated with some level of discordance. But even more interesting than this really is what are the consequences of being in the category of being quote-unquote discordant. And they found that overall the outcomes in all of the groups were quite good, with no real significant difference in things like death. And that the long-term viral suppression immune discordant group was fairly common. They found actually 106 of these patients, but very little difference in the way of long-term outcomes. They went further to try to look a little bit at what's going on immunologically with these people, and they looked at the relationship between being discordant in a small subset of patients, 20, comparing that to a small group of 25 who were concordant. They looked at cellular markers, What they found were that in those patients who were fully suppressed but discordant, they had higher levels of memory CD4 cells with reduced naive memory cells. They also found, interestingly enough, an increased level of CD4 T cell activation amongst those with immune discordance. We generally think of the level of activation declining with the level of immune suppression or virologic suppression. There's been a lot of interest in the potential role of immune activation on the pathogenesis of CD4 depletion in people with HIV. So this was an interesting observation. Although clinically, these are not markers that we're routinely using, nor do we really know what to do about it when it occurs. So I think from this study, probably the most important thing for clinicians is that overall, despite over 100 people being quote-unquote discordant and having lower CD4 responses, the outcomes were quite good. It is worth noting, though, that despite the fact that they fell into the category of being discordant, the CD4s in this group, the highs were in the order of 392 cells, and the range didn't get down to the very low levels. So I think there's some reassurance, and it's an area clearly that needs additional research. So while I think the kind of data that was presented by the group at Washington University are reassuring that for most of our patients who maintain good viral suppression, regardless of their T-cell increase, that they'll probably remain healthy, there are some individuals where we will want to talk to them about potential options. Again, frequently we discuss this in the context of cases. Is there anything we can offer them? One of the things that's often proposed is the possibility of switching a regimen from an NNRTI to a PI-containing regimen. And the rationale for this is preliminarily based upon just some small case series showing maybe better CD4 responses in patients on PIs and NNRTIs. But a more robust data set was presented in the ACTG-5142 trial of patients who were randomly assigned at the time they were treatment naive to nukes with either efavirenz or a PI. They found that there was actually a significantly higher increase in the CD4 elevation amongst those who received the PI than the NNRTIs. The clinical relevance in that setting is not clear, but it's possible to at least think about extrapolating that to this unique population of so-called discordant patients. There was a group that actually did this at this presentation, where they took a population of patients who were fully suppressed, and they defined some who were either partial immune responders, so they had CD4 increases of greater than 50%, and a change in what they defined as CD4 categories of greater than or equal to 1. So a group that were either from less than 100 that went to 100 to 200, or 100 to 200 that went to 200 to 350, and so on. Then they had a group of immune non-responders. These were people who had a CD4 increase of less than 50% and less than a change within these CD4 categories. They identified overall 17 of these patients. 8 of them were randomly assigned to switch to lopinavir-ritonavir-containing regimen, and the majority of them were on NNRTIs at the time. 9 were randomized to continue their therapy. And they simply followed these people for changes in CD4. What they reported, and again, a relatively small data set, was that CD4s generally went up at month 1 and 3 in both groups by about 50 cells. But they found that after month 3, between month 3 and 6, there was actually a dramatic increase in the group that received lopinavir-ritonavir, and it turned out that that was a highly significant increase, suggesting that maybe there is some benefit of a switch towards increasing CD4s, not necessarily that there's any true clinical benefit. They suggested, based on an analysis of apoptosis markers on naive CD4 cells, that this may actually decrease in the people who got switched to lopinavir-ritonavir. They hypothesized that there's maybe some effect that's not related to viral control, since everybody maintained good viral suppression, associated with the use of lopinavir-ritonavir versus NNRTIs that resulted in this improvement in CD4 cells. Again, very small data set. Interestingly, for reasons that aren't completely explained, the benefit was really just seen at 6 months and not seen at 1 month and 3 months. So I think for now, these kinds of decisions are going to still be based upon a detailed discussion with our patients. And we have this small incremental increase in the amount of data that might help guide this type of discussion and therapy in the future. Another challenge that confronts us in the clinic is what to do with patients who experience rashes with NNRTIs, and to what extent may that limit our ability to use other NNRTIs. We'll be talking a little bit more about more detailed presentation on a newer NNRTI, etravirine, but we still have efavirenz and nevirapine that are first-generation NNRTIs and associated with a variable rate of rash in clinical trials and in clinical practice. In a group from Chile, NNRTIs are one of the first-line therapeutics, and their guidelines suggest that if somebody develops a rash on one of the NNRTIs, that they should then go on a boosted PI, presumably because of concerns about cross-reactions. So they actually looked at a subset of patients who initially started on NNRTIs and developed rashes but chose not to follow guidelines. They were able to find about 35 patients who developed a rash on nevirapine were given efavirenz after that. We aren't told the nature of that rash and whether it was a severe hypersensitivity reaction. Presumably it was not. But then they were changed to efavirenz, and they found that of the 35, only 2, or a little less than 6%, ultimately developed a rash. And the rest of the patients did not have a rash and tolerated efavirenz very well. So this is reassuring, at least I would argue, for those who don't have severe hypersensitivity reactions to nevirapine, that many might be able to use efavirenz. They only had a few people who developed rashes primarily on efavirenz, because that was not as commonly used. They had overall 7, of which 2 out of 7 that went on nevirapine, or about a quarter, developed a rash. But in general, these patients all maintain suppression. So I think as long as it's not a severe reaction, this kind of data suggests if there's a good reason to be thinking about switching to the other NNRTI, it can probably be done safely based on this available data. Another common side effect in patients on antiretroviral therapy is gastrointestinal symptoms. One of the more common protease inhibitors currently used is lopinavir ritonavir. As you know, recently the tablet formulation has become available, and the hope was because that the tablets would be better tolerated than soft gel capsules because it eliminated some of the products that were present in the capsules that may act as a laxative. Particularly, it was thought that it might be associated with less diarrhea. And now the tablets are increasingly used in select countries, but not a lot of data yet available on whether it really does improve tolerability. There are large controlled trials that are underway. There was a small observational study that was presented from the group at Emory where they identified 74 patients who were on lopinavir-ritonavir soft gel capsules and then switched to tablets. They asked detailed questions and surveys about their tolerability using surveys or validated instruments to look at bowel habits, global condition improvements, a symptom distress scale, tolerability, quality of life. They looked at lipids. They looked at viral suppression. It turned out that of these individuals, about 25 of them enrolled in the study prior to the switch, and then a larger group, about 49, entered the study within 8 weeks of the switch. They collected the variety of information that I described. Overall, at 4 weeks, they found that more patients preferred the tablets to the soft gel capsule. It was 74% versus 8% in that type of a simple assessment. And that satisfaction with the tablet formulation was particularly true for things like improvement in bowel habits at 4 weeks that was maintained out to week 12. In addition to finding improved GI tolerability, they found a positive impact on the subject's overall well-being. They also, interestingly enough, saw a small improvement in triglycerides at the time of switch, the clinical relevance of which isn't really clear. There's also not a lot of information provided here as to how many of these people may have been receiving this as a twice-a-day versus a once-a-day drug. But at least it's some early data suggesting that indeed the tablets may be better tolerated than the soft gel capsules, which will be helpful as we move forward and we await the larger randomized control data that's pending.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been part one of a two-part CME and CE podcast summarizing research from IDSA 2007. To listen to part two, as well as additional coverage of the conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/IDSA2007.